and welcome to another College of Optometrists podcast with me, Martin Cordner, Head of Research at the College.
And me, Daniel Hardiman-McCartney, Clinical Advisor at the College.
Today we have not one, not three, but two interviews for you to enjoy as part of the new and definitely slightly longer College podcast. I spoke to Jill Adams, Consultant Paediatric Ophthalmologist and Strabismologist at Moorfields Eye Hospital, about eye health warnings in newborn babies, while Daniel caught up with mental health counsellor David Beeney to talk about managing mental health in these challenging times.
Jill spoke to Martin about some of the key health warnings in newborn babies, how their eyes develop in the first 2 years, and what exciting new developments in treatment are on the horizon. And then David spoke to me about the best ways of maintaining our mental resilience as we come out of a range of lockdown scenarios, as well as how you can assess your own mental health and spot signs in colleagues that may be struggling.
So, an action-packed show today, but there's just time to check in with yourself. Daniel, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Martin. Spring is in the air, the birds are singing, mm-hmm. It's lighter in the morning, clocks are about to go back.
Kids have gone away.
Just between 9 and 3 o'clock, but you know what? I think they're much happier being away back at school, and hopefully long may that continue throughout the summer.
Yeah, it's just a break, isn't it? I think, you know, when you spend so much time with each other, you know, you love each other, but also you spend a lot of time with each other. And it's just to be the government to say, yes, you're allowed to not spend time with each other anymore. I mean, that's a perk we don't realise we have until it's taken away.
I think this whole generation will be much more appreciative of the freedom that we have to be able to leave our house without a reasonable excuse and not be stopped on the street and asked where we're going, what we're doing, whether we're exercising. How are you, Martin?
Yeah, no, I mean, not too bad. You know, I think we're all a bit tired of situation, hoping for better times. And yeah, you know, lighter mornings, lighter evenings, and then lighter when the clocks change. What is it again? Is it lighter mornings? It is, isn't it?
It's
lighter all round.
Yeah,
no, it's lighter in the evening because the clocks go forward. That's right. There'll be more light. That's what I'm trying to say.
Martin, there's a burning issue, I think, on all of our listeners' minds. And it's not relating to COVID. It's not relating to amber guidance. No. It's relating to your kitchen. Can you give us
an
update?
That's correct, Daniel. Yes, so an important update for all members. I can't believe it didn't make it into the latest edition of E! News. I've no idea why. Is that I'm still without a kitchen. Yes, I have a sink now. Sink. But not a kitchen. But the presence of a sink makes me think that we're hoping that we're close to maybe nearly being on the way to starting to be not far from finishing. So, I you know, I'd like to say my diet has improved in the interim. I would like to say that.
Well, maybe next month, Martin. Maybe next month. Or maybe next year. We will see. So, okay. You're first here from Martin and Jill, and then from me with my conversation with David, and we'll see you after that.
Jill, thank you very much for joining us.
Our pleasure.
So, you trained initially in Edinburgh, but you've been at Moorfields Eye Hospital since 1985. So how did you come to be joining Moorfields?
Well, I'm a Scot. I was born in Glasgow and I went and trained in Edinburgh, which if you're a Scot, you'll realise is a very big move. And I did all my basic ophthalmic training in Edinburgh, and then I wanted to do more subspecialty training. And Edinburgh likes to think it's the best. I did my medical training there. And there are very few places that you can go. Glasgow's home, so I didn't want to go back home. So I decided I would make the big break and come to London. And I was going to do a year or two. I joined what's called the House, which is the registrar training program at Moorfields. And the idea was to do that registrar training program and come back to Edinburgh. And then life got in the way, so I stayed.
Sure. Tends to be how these things work, isn't it? So what drew you to the fields of paediatric ophthalmology and strabismus specifically?
I think it's got a wonderful mixture of the medicine and the surgery, and you can do a great deal. It's much more generalized. If you're I did the paediatric cataracts for many years. So most people will do adult cataracts, but you know, you did strabismus, you did paediatric cataracts. I look after premature babies. You look after children with generalized problems. So it is very much using all of your medical skills.
So and it was a sort of the different fields rather than necessarily sort of children or developing eyes.
Yes, I think that's true. I think also, you know, you're in a very privileged position. I look after now an adult who's about to become a father, who I did his squint operation on many years ago. Oh, and, wow. You know, it's a very privileged position to be in someone's life for that long time. And I honestly don't think most other people get that privilege. And I think it's probably like being a general practitioner. You spend a lot of time with people over the years in many cases. And it's, I think it's a very important job. So it's the generalization, it's the subspecialty skills, it's the being very involved in a patient. So it's got a glorious mix.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good. I should look into it. So as well as being a consultant ophthalmic surgeon, you were until July 2019 service director for strabismus and neuro-ophthalmology at Moorfields. So you have a lot of insight into how a service runs, presumably seeing an awful lot of change in that time as well. But how are you able to say sort of how you think the service has changed, if it has changed, significantly during the time of the pandemic?
Well, I think the first thing is that looking at how people manage things, there was a stratification of what should continue in the first wave. And right at the top, apart from injury, is looking after babies, premature babies, babies with cataract. So they hit the number one for absolutely must continue service. And then, looking after children is important, but, you know, there's a stratification for what's important. So our service was right up there as one of the most important services to keep running. So I continued going to Great Ormond Street and to the Homerton to the baby units to look after all the babies. But we were short of staff and we continued looking after the strabismus patients. A lot of it by phone. We'd never done phone consultations, video consultations. So that was a very new and different way of doing things. And we cut back on routine operating. Now we caught back up later, but it was the move to the teleplatform, which I think was one of the major changes. That was across the board in the hospital. But, phoning people up and saying, how are your new glasses? Some bits of it don't always work very well, but other things you can do a very good job on by the phone. And you can keep in touch with people and find out what their problems are. So it was the digital bit, sort of came into being. And we set up a Pando group, that's a sort of NHS WhatsApp group, to try and make sure that we had adequate cover to look after all the premature babies in London. And we did that sort of in 48 hours. So the technology that was the thing that I suppose really came to the fore. And Zoom consultations, I don't think, if we'd been told a year or 2 years ago that we're going to do Zoom consultations, I think we'd all have poo-pooed it.
Yes.
But actually, using sometimes the information that old reports and other things can give you allowed us to manage some patients really very successfully without them having to travel. Mm-hmm. So, and then we had to get back on the road when the lockdown ended and do extra theatre lists, extra clinics. People are doing clinics on a Saturday. I did theatre lists on a Saturday to try and get back to where we were before the pandemic struck. Then we had the second lockdown. So you tend to feel like you've been knocked on the head again. But we've continued face-to-face consultations throughout that time just to keep it running. Mm-hmm. So, it's been a bit of a roller coaster. And we've been very short of junior staff because they were all redeployed to the Royal Free and RAH to take care of patients on intensive care. So, different people did different roles to keep things going.
Yes, it must have been an extraordinary amount of change considering how you, as you say, had to change your service, but also the people that you lost and having to move all those moving pieces around. And as well, as you say, the pandemic isn't just one thing. There was lockdown, there was end of lockdown, there was lockdown again. I mean, you've talked there a lot about the digital changes and innovations that to practice that you, I mean, it sounds like you think that could last, that could continue to have a beneficial effect, maybe. Yeah. Is that fair?
I think for some things it will. Mm. I mean, very obviously, you can't check someone's glasses over the phone. It sounds terribly obvious. And one of the things that we found fascinating was that trying to check vision, that sounds terribly easy, but it's not. And we were trying to get parents to check the distance and check a chart. And in the end, our team were sending out pieces of string and blue tack so that they could, with a target for vision on. So, and then people were phoning in, and we found a wonderful American nine gaze where patients or parents take photographs on their mobile phone and then send it in to us of how their eye positions. And so some of that, I think, may stay. Other bits, it's not that useful for. Mm. But for other things, it's, you know, giving people results of their scans or their blood tests, it's very effective, but it still takes time.
Mm.
So I think the digital bit will, I think a lot of that will continue. Hopefully, it will make the process slicker for patients and save people traveling. You know, if you come to an eye appointment, or any appointment in a hospital, you're out for a couple of hours, maybe even more. If you can do a 30 minute phone call, you've saved somebody traveling, you've saved them expense, you saved a kid a day out of school. You know, it's got a lot of potential in the right area to make a big difference to patients.
When you've had conversations with parents about their children's eye related issues during the pandemic, would you say they have differed in any way to previously, have parents had different types of questions as it changed the way the sort of interactions and what people have asked about?
Yeah, I think just on a basic level, we've got parents who understandably are concerned about coming into hospital at COVID time. You know, they don't want their kid to catch COVID, they don't want to catch COVID. And so we've got the safety issue, but we've also got parents or children who are shielding because they are significantly unwell and we've got to manage them remotely. I think sort of wider issues got parents wondering whether they can they bring their child into hospital? Are we open? And of course we're open. We've been open 24 hours a day, every day of the year through that pandemic. So nothing has changed from that score. So I think there's the safety issue. So if you're talking to parents about listing them for surgery, you know, we have to add in the COVID risks and the self-isolation, which, you know, if your kid's just gone back to school after missing nearly a year of school, and we say, well, we'll do your child's squint operation, but you need to take time out of work, or the kid takes time out of school, after a year, that's a big ask for them socially.
Yeah.
I think the other things that have definitely been eye problems, but just on a social level, we've got children who are very frightened. They've been spending their life at home. You suddenly come into a hospital and there's all these people. We're normally dressed up in scrubs, plastic bags, masks, plastic gloves. I mean, it's not exactly an environment we would normally show to children.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, children mirror what you do. You must know with your one. If you stick your tongue out, they stick your tongue out back at you, don't they? And if you smile at them, they smile at you. But if you're behind a mask, they can't work out what you're doing.
Yes.
And we've got kids who are very frightened, very withdrawn, don't like being around other people. If you're a new baby and you've not met another new baby, it's really very scary to meet other people. So there's a lot of interaction problems for kids, I think. And then we've got the kids who've spent 11, 12 hours a day on their computer with homeschooling, homework, catching up with friends on Zoom, and then using their mobile phone for games. And they're getting eye problems. And, you know, it's all because they're inside. It's difficult.
So in the piece you wrote for the Look After Your Eyes website at the beginning of March called Four Eye Health Warnings in Newborn Babies, you explained how babies are examined at 6 to 8 weeks by a GP to rule out any possible health issues. Does that include eye-related issues? Are GPs specifically looking for that?
Yes. I mean, they repeat the red reflex test in particular and look at the eyes. And the thing that they're majorly looking for is an absent red reflex to check for cataract. And it's an old-fashioned test, you might say, but it's a very good test because if it's clear, then you should be pretty clear. If it's abnormal, you may still be all right, but it's got to be checked out by a specialist. But it's the best way of making sure that we don't miss treatable congenital cataract, you know, within the optimum time for doing surgery.
Can you talk to us a little bit about what a child's vision is like when they're born? How it develops over the first 6 months or so?
First of all, babies don't have normal vision at birth. It's at the level of somebody with a white stick when they're born. And it doesn't get to normal 20/20 until you're about two. So it's going through the stages of getting better. But in the first 6 months, when a baby is born, the person it needs to see is the person who is, you know, looking after it, protecting it, feeding it, holding it, looking at it. So yeah, you don't need to see much more than about arm's length in front of your face. And your vision develops as you get up and walk, cruise around. And then by the time you're two and hurtling around as a very independent being, you should have 20/20 vision. So it's it develops as the child develops. There's no point being able to look, you know, 20 feet in the distance if you are a 6 month old baby. You know, there's nothing terribly interesting there. The interesting things and sure, people right in your face. So that's what, you know, nature is designed for you. So as I say, it's very, it's relatively poor at birth, but it does get rapidly better over 2 years.
So what's it like at about age one?
It's probably about 70% of normal, roughly. But, you know, it's well able to do everything you need. You know, find that chocolate bar, find that biscuit, find the thing on the floor that you're not meant to find, you know.
Yes, but clonk me in the jaw. Yep.
Yeah, and then remember, they're not reading very small print at that stage. They're looking at books. It's large print stuff. So it's all very, very brilliantly designed to do what you need to do at the time.
Yeah, we're saving James Joyce's Ulysses until he's able to see it. That's fair.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, so there's lots of other skills developing. There's language skills developing. Yeah. There's skills developing. So it's all got to sort of work in tandem. And, you know, no six-monther is going to be running. And so their vision's sort of keeping up at that sort of pace. But by two, you'd expect them to be walking around pretty steadily. So the vision is exactly the same sort of developmental level. It's all meant to gel very nicely together.
Yes, almost like it works together perfectly. So you were talking about cataracts slightly earlier, and you say in the piece that cataracts at birth are rare, obviously very good, but can you talk to us about what actually causes them at birth, and if operated on at that time, are there long-term consequences or follow-up needed as the child grows?
Well, I think the first thing is just to emphasize that it is rare. It's about 250 kids a year in the UK are born with congenital cataract. Most of it is genetic. In other words, it may be inherited down the family line, or it may be a mutation in your genetic makeup. It can be due to infection. If you go outside of the UK to the developing world, measles is a well-recognized cause. Sometimes infections caught by the mother during pregnancy, toxoplasmosis, things like that can cause it. But as I say, the vast majority, and particularly as our genetic testing gets better, kids that we didn't know what the cause was maybe 5-10 years ago, we're discovering when we do things called gene panels, that there is a cause in the genetic makeup of the child. So you look for infections, you look for metabolic conditions, but more and more the blood is being sent for genetic analysis. Now the problem is that the genetic testing does take time to come back, so you have to make your decisions on management of the child often before you get the genetics back. But it will inform the parents if there's a problem that might affect another child or another member of the family. So if you've got dense cataracts, you know, white cataracts that the baby can't see, that baby will need surgery. And we usually say by about 10 weeks, possibly a bit before. There's a balance. If you operate too young, if you operate before the age of 4 weeks, there is a very significant risk that the baby will get secondary glaucoma. So you've got to get, you don't want to go there, but if you leave it very late, the baby will get what's called deprivational amblyopia. In other words, the brain pathways just won't learn to see.
Yeah. So what's very late in terms of time?
Well, 4 months, 5 months, you know, significantly affected. So there's this Goldilocks period of trying to minimize the side effects, but at the same time, give the kid a good vision. So, you know, but after 6 weeks and before 12, you know, so sort of depending on when, and that's why the GP check at 6 to 8 weeks is important, because if the child has been picked up at that exam, they've got to get back into the hospital service early, and then they've got to be checked out, and then they've got to be got into surgery. So it's, you know, it's a fairly efficient process if you've got that to get them in that Goldilocks time period.
And in terms of follow-up, as the child grows, 1, 2, 3, 4, is there any particular follow-up needed? Does anything need to happen? Or
as I used to say to the parents, you know, we're taking each other on for life.
I see, right.
They are almost certainly going to need long-term follow-up. In the first few years, you're checking that the very, very little ones, they need glasses or contact lenses, they need checking for glaucoma, they need checking for lazy eye, they need checking for strabismus. But even once you get them through the first 6 or 7 years, they will need to be monitored for pressure in their eyes, glaucoma, for essentially for the rest of their life. Now that, as they get older, they may well be able to go to their local optometrist, you know, to do that for them. But this is, you know, when you've got that, it's a long-term issue.
Sure.
And it needs long-term care. And, you know, glasses, contact lenses, if you put an intraocular lens implant in, someone's got to look at that, make sure there's no capsule thickening. So they are somebody under care for the rest of their life. It's, you know, and when they're very young, they may be coming to the hospital every week to 2 weeks. It's a big load for the parents to carry.
Right. So one of the other conditions you cover in the blog is strabismus, and you point out that up to 70% of babies are born with a constant to occasional squint, which resolves itself within the first few months. So Do we know why the figure is so high at birth? I mean, I know we've basically spoken about this. Is it, you know, it's like that because when children are born, it's not a problem that it's like that, and then it resolves itself because the system develops, or is there something else going on?
It seems to be a developmental thing. They start with their eyes slightly out of centre. Somebody once looked at thousands and thousands of babies in a neonatal nursery. I don't know, but, and I don't think anybody really knows, but when people go to sleep, your eyes roll up and out.
Right.
And many babies spend quite a lot of time asleep when they're very small.
Right. Makes sense.
So whether it's something to do with that, but there seems to be a developmental thing that as the baby seems to be getting more alert, looking at things, their eyes come inward. So a little outturned divergence in the very early weeks of life, in fact, is normal, and they all seem to straighten up. And there's a suggestion that premature babies may have a different process doing that, but you know, it's very, very normal in the first few weeks.
Okay, so it might be because sleep causes outwards, and then as they look more, they have more practice inwards, but we're all just speculating here.
Yeah. I think we're speculating. I don't think anyone really knows, because you can't say to a baby, why are you doing that?
That's quite...
you know, but it does seem to be a developmental process with so many of them starting out not quite well aligned. And then maybe as they're taking more interest in the world around them, starting to latch on to looking straight ahead.
Conjunctivitis of the newborn can in some circumstances cause serious damage to the eye. How does that process work, and how can you tell the difference? I'm using you to mean anyone really, tell the difference between potentially serious and hopefully not so serious conjunctivitis.
Yeah, really serious conjunctivitis is mainly associated with gonococcus infection. And it occurs quite early after birth, and it's got copious greeny yellow discharge, and the lids are very tense and swollen. So you've got a baby who may or may not have a temperature, with gummed up eyes, with that tense red skin. And if you open the lids, you can get a jet. You know, the standard advice is stand to the side, not in front, when you open those lids, because there's pus under pressure coming out.
Wow.
And what happens is that pus gives an abscess in the cornea and causes corneal damage, and it actually can cause a perforation. Now, that's why mothers in pregnancy will be swabbed for, you know, for bacteria in their cervix, not just for gonococcus, but for group B strep because of the risk of meningitis. But it's to try and make sure the baby doesn't pick anything up as it's born.
Right.
Now, you can pick up infection from caregivers, and from, you know, dirt in the atmosphere, you know, people cough all over your baby and things like that. You might get upper respiratory stuff, but the really nasty gonococcus is almost certainly caught at the time of delivery, you know, as you're born. And so it's very early in life with, as I say, copious, florid pus. The baby has really stick, you know, it really is, you know, the baby's eyes are just gummed together. And the thing you're worried about is that, you know, there are other infections that the baby can pick up. But when a baby is born, if they've got serious infection, they can get temperature and they can get systemically unwell. And as you'll find out, when a baby goes down, they go down very fast. So they can really go downhill very quickly. That's why if they have got that, we take what we call Gram slides. We plate it on a glass. Things that the lab can do an immediate look at it to see what sort of bugs there are. And these babies, you know, even at 5 days old, will need admission and intravenous antibiotics. So, you know, and, you know, you can imagine it's pretty scary. You've had a baby and then this poor little thing gets this red, sticky, you know, sometimes even blood-stained discharge. And then it's taken into hospital and it's got drips put up on it.
Absolutely.
So it can be a very difficult... thankfully, that gonococcus is very rare, but there are other infections that babies can pick up. And, you know, a lot of it is what we call flora, you know, stuff on the skin, you know, staphylococcus, streptococcus, but they can get copious, you know, really nasty. And if there's any doubt, we liaise with our pediatricians and they get started on antibiotic, and the pediatrician makes the call as to whether that's going to be intravenous or whether it's going to be oral. But because babies can become significantly unwell in a very short time period, most of the pediatricians will say, right, intravenous.
Right. So in terms of telling the difference, it sounds like you can't miss it. If it's serious, you're going to know.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at it and you think, if it's sticky, slimy, you think it might be one type of bug. If it's yellow, it's probably Staphylococcus aureus. But, you know, there is no such thing as looking at it and saying it doesn't matter. The only way you can do that, you've got to go take the swab, send it to the lab and start treating it in combination with your pediatrician. You know, you don't take chances.
Sure. So watery eyes can be caused by the nasolacrimal duct not having opened fully.
Yep.
A massage can alleviate that problem. But are there any other ducts, connections, bits, which can also sort of not fully open and potentially at birth? Are there any consequences to those, or is it only the nasolacrimal that we need to be worrying
about? Well, congenital glaucoma, which is, you know, rare, 50 babies a year, they have a membrane internally which blocks the passage of fluid between the front and the back, and it sort of stops the fluid draining normally. So you could all argue that that's a type of system that doesn't open up normally.
Yes.
Other than that, it's very rare to see a baby's eyes fused together, you know, things that don't open. You only really see that in a sort of 23-week or lower gestation baby. So it's really nasolacrimal duct and, you know, a membrane within inside the eye, which you can't see unless you use a special gonioscope, which is a special lens.
So, in terms of that then, and on the congenital glaucoma, so that would cause potentially an enlarged eye, if that was the problem.
Yes.
So, I mean, this might be a very stupid question, but how can you tell if an eye is enlarged when they're tiny and wee?
Euthymos comes from the word for oxeye. So usually they are much bigger than normal, and the cornea, if I could say, has got that slightly dead fish look, you know, when you go in and you know, they always say fish should have a lovely bright, you know, glossy eye, and if it's got that slightly not quite as bright as you want, and the kid's got these tears coming out the eye and they're very sensitive to light, those are the sort of things that would make you sort of really worried. You know, the child who really shuts their eyes, screws up their eyes, screams in the light, got super big eyes, but they're slightly hazy. That's the one you're worried about.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. Are there any other conditions, you know, related to newborn babies that were sort of top 10 rather than top 4 in terms of the things that you mentioned in your list? You know, is there anything that you think, well, this is rare but it comes up a bit, or this is something that, you know, you've seen very occasionally but is sort of interesting pathologically?
Well, I think about 7% of babies in the UK are born prematurely, and some are born very, very prematurely. And if you're born 30 weeks 31 weeks or less, you have got a risk of getting retinopathy of prematurity, where the blood vessels at the back of the eye don't develop normally. And about 4% of these babies will need treatment with laser or injections into the eye. But it's incredibly important, because it, you know, if we don't get that right, they can have detached retinas, and that can lead to blindness for the rest of their life. So it's very important for these kids that we, that's why there's a national screening program for these babies, and national guidance on treating them. So it, that may be rare, but there's about 320 odd babies a year in the UK need that sort of treatment. So again, not a large number, but incredibly important for those children and their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that we see are droopy eyes, droopy eyelids, ptosis, where one lid is low or both lids are lower than normal. And it can give you that sort of rather chilled appearance. You know, you just, you can't be, you haven't opened your eyes. If it's very bad, you know, if the kid's eyelid or eyelids are shutting so that they can't see, or they're having to put their chin up, they can need urgent surgery, but we try and leave surgery in the hope that things will develop a bit better. We sometimes want to, well, we always want to check if the pupils are normal or abnormal, because if you get a droopy eyelid with a small pupil, you can have what's called Horner syndrome. And we can see that after a forceps delivery, one where the shoulder's been pulled back. And also we want to make sure that, that they haven't got any problems in their neck. So lids, funny pupils, these are things that we see. The unequal pupils is not an uncommon thing. And again, we're looking for a Horner syndrome, but about 20% of babies will have a 1 millimeter difference between the two pupil sizes.
Yeah.
We also get babies where people have taken photographs and see white reflexes. Now that's probably because of, you know, just the camera angle, but obviously we need to make sure that they haven't got cataract or retinal detachment or a tumor at the back of their eyes. Yes. Now in babies, this tumor is very rare. That's usually in the 2 and 3 year old, but a detached retina or an abnormality in the retina, or what's called a coloboma. So if you get a cat's eye pupil, remember the Madeleine McCann case, she got a cat's eye iris,
right,
and that associated with a similar sort of defect in the retina, and that can give you a white appearance on your camera. And it's important to know about that, because it can be, you can have other conditions in the body and your kidneys and things like that, and in your heart. So it's important that you know if there's any problems in there. And, you know, we're often called in by our neonatal colleagues to examine eyes in children who've got concerns about development or kidney function. And we're asked to have a look at that and see if there's any problems in the retina which might help them in their diagnosis.
So what would you say is the most straightforward way to check that a baby's vision is developing normally? I mean, as a new parent, you're doing that thing where you're sort of going, walking around the room and going, oh, it's following me, oh, it's following me. Is it as simple as that, or is there something a bit more?
No, I think that basic and obvious things are the baby should smile back at you. As I say, they love mimicking you.
Yeah.
So if you go and stand in the cot, don't clap, because if you make a noise, they'll do it by hearing.
Yes. Yeah.
So you've got to sort of look quietly over and just look at them and smile at them and see if they're, you know, if they'll smile back. Because if they're smiling back at you, they're obviously seeing you.
Yes,
and mimicking. Sure. And then if you hold a hand out, you know, they should automatically go and look.
Mm-hmm.
So clanking toys aren't always a good idea, because they will be looking at the noise. But if you've got a light, you know, you can just use your flash, your torchlight, and you put the light on, they should move. Because mm-hmm. babies are interested in things. And so I think, you know, obvious things like, are they, you know, but as I say, if you go down there and make lots of noise, of course they're going to look. So it's to do it quietly and then just see if they track light, if they mimic your smile. People know very quickly if they don't think their baby sees, because you know, the baby just has wandering eyes and they're not looking at them. So a baby should be really fixated on a parent or caregiver who is literally in their face. So that's the thing that you notice.
Yes, I think we've found, you know, that our son is very interested in our mobile smartphones, but based on the amount of time I spend on my phone, I think I'm very interested in it as well. So fair enough. Would you say there are any new development in diagnosing or treating eye health issues in babies that you're particularly excited about, that you see coming around the corner, either in sort of specialist practice or more general practice?
I think the thing that's probably going to be really exciting is gene therapy, which the NHS has just funded or starting fund.
Right.
And obviously it's new territory. And, you know, the one that they've been doing is for older people, for kids. But there are some conditions, retinal dystrophies, where the retina doesn't function properly, where, you know, the baby doesn't learn to see properly. And it looks like there will be some therapy for that, where they inject chemical underneath the retina. So in other words, the baby has an operation. And it looks like this may well help solve this problem, you know, and that's completely revolutionary. Yeah. These were children who were destined to stay blind for the rest of their lives. And so, you know, gene therapy is going to sort of revolutionize and open up our world. Obviously, that means you have to take blood to have a genetic analysis of what's going on. You can't just look at a child and go, well, I think we'll just inject this because it might work. Can't do that. And you know, some of these therapies are going to cost over £500,000.
Right.
There will be a significant demand that, you know, you know which one you're doing. But I think that's going to be a complete game changer. The other thing is that the myopia epidemic.
Yes.
Now about 50% of UK teenagers are short-sighted. That's gone up during the lockdown. The new term that's been coined for it by our American colleagues is quarantine myopia.
Right.
And of course, once you become short-sighted, you don't go back. And in some countries in the world, they're sort of, it's nearly 90% of their children are short-sighted. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a big change, I think, which we are already seeing, you know, more children. You know, then myopia's got worse.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, treatments for or to try and stop myopia progressing are becoming great interest, and I think will be something that we are looking at much more closely. There's new contact lenses, there's new spectacle lenses, which our optometry colleagues will hopefully be prescribing for these kids. So I think, you know, those are sorts of, you know, in the past, if someone said, what can you do to stop short sight? And you go, now you can say, well, you can say, well, you can send them outside, but you can't during lockdown. You can try and limit their screen time. Good luck if they're on homeschooling. But you can use specialist contact lenses. And if the younger children, you can use special lenses. And the talk about the drops trial for atrophy. So, you know, there's suddenly lots of things that you can do which you weren't able to do before. So I think that's going to be interesting. Obviously, there are always new pieces of kit.
Mm-hmm.
But I think those are the sort of things which are the interesting things.
Yes, I can certainly say that from our perspective at the College of Optometrists, you know, myopia is the thing that could be dominating the future for quite a while because, there's an awful lot going on there.
Absolutely. But if we started the pandemic with 50% of our teenagers short-sighted, we're not going to be doing anything other than ending the pandemic with more than that. We don't want the children to become high myopes. I mean, that's the aim of the game, stop them getting to that the -6 number. You know, some of these children, you know, the numbers are higher because they've been spending their time inside on their, you know, they've had to spend their time inside on their laptop or their iPad. You know, that's how they've got their education.
Food for thought. Well, thank you very much for your time, Jill. That was great.
A pleasure. Thank you for the questions.
So, David, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Really enjoyed your webinar. Really interesting session. Lots of people tuned in to listen to it. So thank you very much. How are you feeling today?
I'm good. It's a Friday afternoon, so I'm excited about having a couple of days off. But I'm tired as well. It's been a very, very busy week. But overall, I'm okay. Thank you for asking, Daniel.
You're very welcome. Well, one of the topics you brought up in the webinar was it's okay not to be okay. And you described some strategies that people can adopt to help that. Can you tell us more about that? Remind us what they were.
I think if I reflect on these days, how I cope with my battles with panic attacks, because I spent 36 years, to remind you, avoiding public speaking. And now as part of my work talking about panic attacks, I'm public speaking the whole time. So people have said to me, you know, how do you get through these sessions? And one is truly embracing that phrase that it really is okay not to be okay. Most of my career, I was too hard on myself. I've lowered my bar. I don't mean I've lowered my standards. I've just lowered the expectations I put on myself. These days, I've accepted it's okay not to be okay. I've given myself permission to have panic attacks, with the irony being when you give yourself permission, at that point, you reduce the chances they're going to happen because you're being kinder to yourself. You're lowering your anxiety levels. You're lowering your pressure points. And I think I have discovered what they call self-compassion. And equally, I've also seen the power of sharing vulnerabilities, Daniel. It used to be regarded as weakness to talk about your mental health. But these days, you inspire people around you when you share vulnerabilities. So the combination of accepting that I'm me and I'm comfortable in my own skin, being kinder to myself, knowing that I inspire people when I share vulnerabilities has all really helped with my overall well-being. Thanks.
You mentioned self-compassion there, and self-compassion, self-care. I guess it's a bit of a trendy thing to talk about at the moment, but what does it mean, self-care? Does it mean me just, you know, going off and watching a video, or does it mean me meditating? What does self-care really mean?
I think it's a combination of things. I'm forever saying to people that when I give people advice about becoming more mentally resilient, that I don't talk about anything we haven't heard before. So it is about making sure you're getting sufficient sleep. It is about making sure that you're getting regular exercise, even if it's just going for a walk around the streets where you live for half an hour a day. It is about creating me time in your life and doing things, not just for the family and the kids and your parents. It's about doing things for you to make you feel good about yourself. It is about giving yourself things to look forward to. It's about spending more time in your life with people who you know love you, who care about you, and less time with people who drain you of energy. So it's just about putting yourself first. I know you've heard me talk about before the old oxygen mask. You know, if you're on a plane with kids and the oxygen mask come down, who do you put it on first? Yourself. And that should apply to life every day. But too many people don't put their own oxygen mask on first. I think that's what I mean.
So David, I'm terrible at these things, and I say I'm going to exercise more, and I go through a period of 3 months and doing it, and then it kind of drifts off, or with sleep as well. You know when you are really busy at work and you're like, oh, I'll just step a bit later to finish off my end of year accounts or to write that report and things like that. Do you have any tips that you can suggest about how people can sleep, for example? How can they avoid the barriers or excuses that prevent them from getting good sleep or good exercise?
One is to listen to a fabulous podcast like this one, where we're giving really good tips about how to look after your well-being. Secondly, and I've done this for about 30 odd years, I write things down every day in the old-fashioned way about things that I must do. And I write at the top of my list every day, go for a walk, to make sure it happens. I know it's a very simple thing, but for someone like me, simple work. If you're lucky enough to have a very good partner too in life, my partner keeps an eye on me. And she's forever saying to me, David, you preach all this stuff, but you don't always do it yourself. So she makes sure that I get sufficient sleep. She makes sure that I eat healthily. She makes sure that I have time doing things that make me feel good about myself. So if you're not great at it yourself and you've got someone in your life, someone who really cares about you, use somebody else to nag you as well. Not I should use the word nag, by the way. When I say nag, she doesn't like that word.
To coach you.
Coach me, that's it. That's a much better word, Daniel. Much better word. She coaches me.
So I guess I love the list idea, because I love writing a list at the start of the day. So putting on those wellness breaks or exercise into the list and working collaboratively with your friends, with your partner, to actually remind you and say, you know what, you should do it today. It's raining, but actually go out for that walk anyway, that kind of thing. In terms of tips for organization, so I know a lot of people listening to this will be business owners, they'll have small businesses, maybe 10 employees, things like that. You mentioned an example about HSBC in the webinar. Do you have any tips for how business owners can really, you know, make cultural change in their organization?
Yeah, I have. There's a few things here. As we all know, culture comes top down. The people who run a business, the people at the very top of that organization, they have to show evidence themselves that they are changing their behaviors to create a kinder culture. I'll be honest with you today. I still work with far too many clients where the people who actually run the business are ticking a box. They get someone like me in because they've heard that I do good talks. They don't even come to the talk themselves because they think they don't need to. but they do need to, because people spot whether they're there or not. And ideally as well, we need senior leaders and people who run businesses to share their mental health stories. Now, a lot of people listening to me at the moment will say, well, David, I haven't got my own mental health story. It doesn't have to be about you. It could be about your best friend. It could be about your next door neighbor. But if you can talk about mental health, what you're doing is giving other people in your organization permission to talk about mental health too. So firstly, because we're talking about culture, it has to come from the very top of the organization. Otherwise, it will feel like tick box. Secondly, Daniel, we've all worked for a crap manager and we know what that feels like. You can work for a brilliant organization with a great culture, but if your boss is not very kind and doesn't treat you very well, you don't get that experience. So again, to anyone running a business, if you know you've got managers in your organization that you wouldn't want to work for, you've got to do something about it. You've got to call out poor behavior. And the trouble is, there's still far too many managers out there who don't know how to treat their people well and with respect. I talk a lot these days about kindness in the workplace, and kindness is not a fluffy subject. It's not HR's latest thing. When you create a kinder culture in a business, your best people won't leave. Less people go off with long-term work-related stress. And generally, you drive greater emotional engagement. I'm doing this today from Hemel Hempstead in Hertfordshire. And there's a business in Hemel Hempstead where their CEO said to his staff at the start of the pandemic last year, he said, he sent out a video message to all of his staff saying, at the moment, I don't care about sales. I don't care about sales at all. He said, my priority is to make sure we've still got a great business at the end of this that we're all still proud to work for. And he said again to his sales force, at the moment, I don't care about sales. Well, you can guess what happened. Sales went up because his people were so inspired by the authenticity of his messaging that they wanted to work even harder for that organization. Now, it takes real balls to say to your sales force, I don't care about sales, because of course he did. But when you generally put well-being at the very sort of top of your priorities, you're looking after the needs of the business in the best possible way. So yes, the tone has to come from the top. Yes, every line manager, everyone responsible for people needs to be trained on the power of asking somebody, how are you, before you get into KPIs and objectives and work stuff. I've been doing this for 5 years now, working with organizations around kindness. And trust me, the best way to look after the needs of any business is to put well-being as one of your strategic priorities.
So I'm really interested on that. So in the webinar, and just now you mentioned about starting conversations for kindness. And if you're a business owner and you feel like, right, that means at the start of every meeting I have with an employer, I'm going to say, how are you? And then move on. That's not enough. Saying it isn't enough. It's actually really believing, really inside, wanting to listen with all the energy you have about how your employees are. You'll say it has to come from the heart almost. It can't just be a tick box exercise for it to work.
I couldn't agree more. One of the worst bosses I ever had, he always asked me how I was, but he never ever listened. He carried on writing his next email, and it was rude. And I'd rather he hadn't asked me at all. When you ask, it's got to be authentic. And you've got to create time at the beginning of meetings so you can have time for people to check in and talk about their lives and realize that the value of those moments. I'll be honest with you. At one stage last week, when I got home from work, I'd been in about 20 minutes and my partner said to me, so how was my day? And I said, I don't know what you mean. What do you mean, how was your day? She goes, well, when you walked in the door tonight, you asked me how my day was, but you didn't listen. I did tell you, but you actually went on to do other stuff. So she said, I'm just making a point, David. I know you're preaching every day about the importance of asking people how you are, but even you at times ask people, but you don't always listen. And it was a real slap on the wrist for me, but I was so glad she did it because it reminded me the importance, as you said, Daniel, of really actively listening when you ask that question. It has to come from the heart. You have to mean it when you ask that question. Thank you.
And it's not easy, is it either? Or also actually attuning your attention into someone and really listening with kindness and all the energy you have. It takes practice. It's difficult.
It does. It's not easy. And again, we need to be brave enough and get people to call it out when they know they're not being listened to. because it's that important to get it right.
In your webinar, you used changing topic a little bit now, a wonderful analogy about frogs slowly boiling in a pan of water. And I have this image of these frogs there, and it's quite messy, actually. But can you tell us more about that, you know, putting things off, the danger related to, be it an organization or an individual just putting things off or just leaving things or saying, oh, things will get better next month?
Well, I'll give you a very live story from yesterday. I'm very cynical about statistics around mental health, simply because for many, many years, no one knew about me. I didn't appear in any statistics. And I've since discovered how many other people suffer like me. So obviously I'm dubious about statistics, but for someone who's very dubious about statistics, I quote many. And one of them is that if you woke up this morning for the first time with symptoms of depression, do you know when you're likely to seek professional help? If I ask yourself, when would you think, if you woke up today for the first time with symptoms of depression, when do you think you might go for help?
I'd probably need a lot of more. Like, it would probably be months. Probably, if not longer, actually. I'd probably leave it. I'd probably say, oh, it'll probably get better tomorrow, next week. Probably the same as if I'd about going to the GP about a rash. So, oh, well, I'll give it a few weeks first and see if it gets better.
Well, I've been quoting for a number of years now the statistic that supposedly we wait for 6 to 8 years. So, for example, if you woke up this morning, round about the year 2027, you would actually finally seek professional help. Well, I still do mental health counselling every week. And I was with a new client yesterday. And the client shared with me that they were convinced that they had depression, but they'd always put off dealing with it. And I said to them yesterday, when did you first experience, do you think, symptoms of depression? And they said to me, about 8 years ago. And I sat there and I smiled and I shared with them this statistic I'd heard. You know, although I'm cynical about these statistics, there's probably a lot of truth in that. Because when it comes to physical health, we do think about contacting a GP surgery within 24, 48 hours. And if we don't think about contacting the doctor, someone who loves us will nag us about going to see a doctor. Because mental health is invisible, and because we tend to hide from people around us what's really going on, it's so easy to hide it. It's so easy to put it off. You know, I hid my mental health from 24 years old through into my mid-50s with nobody knowing about it, and me putting it off for all that time about dealing with it at all.
In the webinar, you mentioned that a lot of people don't use the term mental illness enough. They don't talk about their own experiences enough. And I wonder if one of the barriers that some people have is that they're concerned that, you know, counselling, mental health counselling, psychotherapy, all of these different things are very scary. That's for other people. It's all a bit weird. It's all a bit quackery. As a counsellor yourself, is there anything you could say to reassure people about what it's about, what the purpose is, or it's not about brainwashing, or, you know, those common stigmas that people have?
Yeah, to me, the best phraseology of counselling or therapy is talking therapy. It's just the benefit of talking to somebody and being listened to non-judgmentally in a safe space. The best phrase associated with mental health, which virtually everybody knows, but very few people associate it with mental health, is a problem shared is a problem halved. What frustrates me about the world of counselling is that I've probably seen 50 different GPs in my life. And of those 50, I've had at least 10 probably not great experiences where I came out of the surgery thinking they weren't great today. But I would never again think I'm never going to see a doctor again in my life because I've had a bad experience. Many, many people try counselling once, maybe twice, and they get into their heads, it's not for me. I've tried counselling, it's not for me. Sadly, there's such a lack of education around counselling. Most people don't understand. There's three completely contrasting modalities and more. So when you go to counselling, you're often sitting with a counsellor and you don't know what that experience is going to be like before you get there. So for example, I'm a person-centred counsellor. I believe that nobody knows Daniel like Daniel and that the answers lie within you. So in our relationship, you're the expert. I'm here to create a safe space, non-judgmental, empathic, and I'm going to help Daniel to explore the answers that lie within Daniel. So as many times as you ask me, what do you think I should do, David? I will say back to you, well, what do you think you should do, Daniel? But people come to me for advice, and I'm not there to advise people. the danger is they don't get a great experience. So there's also such a fine line, Daniel. There is a fine line between coaching somebody and therapy. Such a fine line between mentoring and counseling. And if you said to someone, I'm going to give you a life coach, and they're going to really help your mind to become healthier, they would think, that's fantastic. But explain to someone that, all right, instead of that, we're called my mental health counselor. They probably wouldn't turn up because of the embarrassment and the stigma of being seen talking to a mental health counselor.
It would be wonderful if there's a change, wasn't there? So like CEOs at the moment, part of the packages you get a life coach, a coach to help you with difficult decisions, safe space, talking about different things. But if everyone had access to that regular top-up space to be able to talk through things, even when things weren't bad, before they got to the point where they were depressed or felt they had problems, just to be able to share all of those things that get you down and make you feel difficult, but that was normalized, you know, at an early age, that everyone could do that no matter what. Do you think we'll get to a society where that will be the case?
I don't think it will happen in my lifetime. I'm being real here. I want to get to the stage where we think about mental health in the same way we think about physical health. We have such a long way to go. I'm asked very, very regularly, David, where are we with the stigma? People say to me, there's been so much more attention given to the world of mental health in recent years. And there has been, but we've still got an exceptionally long way to go. I think it's the final taboo in the workplace. And we've left it to last. And do you know why we've left it to last? It's because it's the most difficult one to deal with. Not many years ago, we associated mental health with madness and asylums. And we're still coming slowly away from that time. And us men, particularly men, we really struggle with this topic, really struggle with it.
We'll come back onto the men point in a bit. Wanted to ask you about, you know, being a clinician. You have a problem, you have a treatment, and it works, you feel better, you spring in your step. With a mental illness, how do you know you're better? At what point do you say, oh, I don't need to do it anymore, it doesn't matter, that's it, I'm cured? Or is it ongoing? Is it about a life-changing kind of changes to your life forevermore?
As you know, Daniel, I'm one of those people who thinks that we mustn't talk about one in four. It is one in one, because everyone's got health, both physical and mental. And again, it's about thinking about them in the same way. Because if you want to stay physically fit throughout your life, you'll regularly do things to keep yourself physically fit. And mental health largely is the same. And we need to continually look after our mental well-being. We tend to focus in life on things that we can measure. And one of my views is that the reason we focus so much on physical health is because there's so many ways of measuring it. Certainly if you go to a gym these days, you can get everything measured to do with your physical health. And the reason we don't focus on our mental health is because we think we can't measure it. And like you said then, well, how would you know when you're better? I think we overcomplicate it. Nobody knows you like you. And it's about just being honest with yourself. If we kept it very simple and we said, well, Daniel at the moment is only 6 out of 10, you'd know why you were 6 out of 10. You would know if it was a relationship issue, a health issue you're putting off, a work issue, finance issue. And it's about being honest with yourself and what's affecting your mind at the moment and what's keeping you awake at night. So I think we've got to get to the stage where we can measure it ourselves and we know when we're okay. I talk a lot about 1 to 10 because it's a global language we all understand. We all know 7's okay. So if you're honest with yourself and say at the moment, I'm 7 out of 10, then you're okay. If you're 6, there's something that's perhaps bugging you a bit. If there's 5, you know, I think we all read it in the same way or largely in the same way.
Let's talk about men and suicide, actually. Let's be quite open and frank about it. I was taken back by the stat that you gave in the webinar, and I think I've heard it before. It's shocking, isn't it, that the most common cause of death in men under 50 is suicide. It's not cancer, it's not prostate cancer, it's not road traffic accidents, it's suicide. And so this is a really serious public health issue. What should people do, you know, if they're listening to this and they've had suicidal thoughts, or they've had thoughts that their life isn't worth living anymore, or they know people who may be showing signs, like you discussed in the webinar, where they're not okay? What should they do?
Just going back to men briefly, we have got to stop saying to men from a very early age, you're a big boy now. Big boys don't cry. That's what girls do. Because we are so conditioned to hide our emotions compared to females. And that has to be the root of the problem about why we can't talk about things when we get older. There are big variations around the UK culturally that impact on the suicide statistics. So for example, the highest suicide rates in the UK, I believe, are in Belfast. And when I was working in Belfast last year at a law firm, I was talking to them about this. And it's because in Belfast, men are real men. That sort of conditioning from a young age that you just got to man up and be a real man is more apparent in places like Northern Ireland than it is in other parts of the UK. There's pretty similar patterns in cities like Glasgow as well. So to start with, we've got to start, as I say, from a very early age, not conditioning men to hide their emotions. I don't know if some people saw the very good program on TV recently by Roman Kemp. He lost his friend to suicide a couple of years ago, and there weren't any signs at all. So they were reflecting on that program about what we can do. Now, there's no magic wand. One of the things they suggested with men, which I love the simplicity of it, is when you say to a guy, how are you? And they say, fine. Ask them again, but say, how are you really? And very often, by asking it twice, you get a different response the second time round. I'm picturing one of those razors, Daniel, where you've got the double blade and the second blade comes along and really picks it up. So we have got to get better at doing the basics of just asking people how they are more regularly and perhaps asking twice to get that response the second time. We have got to get better at noticing, not interpreting. So when you spot any noticeable change in behavior of anybody in your life, we've got to get better at saying, look, I care about you. I've noticed this. Is everything okay? With going back to men particularly again, when a man shares his vulnerabilities, he gives permission for other men to share their vulnerabilities too. I do work with the Royal Navy, and I've had some very, very senior people in the Royal Navy in the last year share their vulnerabilities about mental health. And it's been like an I'm Spartacus moment. What they've done at that point is give other men permission to put their hand up and say, I've had mental health challenges too. So let's not underestimate again the importance of people sharing their vulnerabilities to help other people to share their vulnerabilities too.
Do you think the influence of what we perceive as success is a problem as well? Like, you need to be partner by the age of 30, you need to drive a fast car, your business needs to be hugely successful, you need to be the top of the lead table at work. And if you're not doing those things, all those markers for success, that you're a failure. And that drives the problem. We need to view, well, you know, actually you're co-parenting and you're spending half the time at home with your family. Isn't that a wonderful thing? That's success. Or redefine how we view success, particularly relating to men.
I think so, very much so. Think about children at the moment when they're under pressure to achieve certain grades and exams. You want to say to parents, you just want your kids happy, surely. As long as they're happy and in, got a smile on their face, that's what it's really all about. Let's not put pressure on people too young to be successful from a very early age. But success does come into it. One of my roles with what I do is to dispel myths that you can't be successful if you suffer with poor mental health. Fortunately, more and more hugely successful people are realizing that it's been the challenges in their mind that have driven them to be successful. So it's a complete myth that you can't be successful if you've suffered with poor mental health.
David, thank you very much for giving up your time this afternoon to do a recap of the session, a really important session and a conversation that I've really enjoyed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been an absolute pleasure. I hope to do it again sometime. Thank you.
Absolutely. And I'd just like to say, if anyone's listening to this and they feel affected by the conversation this afternoon or by the webinar, and you want to talk to someone, there's the Samaritan's number, which is 116123. Or, as David suggested, talk to a partner, a friend, let people know you're not okay. It's very important. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to Jill Adams and to David Beeney for their time and insights. You can read Jill's blog for eye health warnings in newborn babies at lookafteryoureyes.org and find out more about David's work at breakingthesilence.co.uk.
Please feel free to subscribe, rate and review the podcast wherever you found this one. And really, feel no pressure. Although you may be aware that you will make Martin sad if you don't, and he doesn't have a kitchen at the moment, so you really will be making things much, much worse.
You will. Sorry to bang on about it, but there you go. That's it from us for this month. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.